So the five spiritual faculties are then a very important part of meditation practice, and they're kind of like the grammar of meditation practice. And understanding them, in a sense, they balance out, or can help us balance out the tendency the hindrances have of diverting us from our attention. And these are things that help us to develop a very strong and stable attention. And before I tell you what those are, I would like to, I'm kind of inspired to read you a passage from this text, and hopefully it's tied in this talk. This is from what's called the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch. It's called the Platform Sutra because it was supposed to be been given on the ordination platform. They often, in ancient China, they gave talks on Buddhism and meditation on the, where they ordained monks or nuns, the platform. But it's kind of like, you know, have a political platform in the United States. You know, there's kind of the position that a party takes is its platform. And this text was so important in the history of Zen that it became, for some schools of Zen, it kind of became like the platform for the Zen tradition. And the heart of this, or so-called heart of this text, then, is section 13, which goes like this. So remember, you listen now. Listen, you're going to listen to kind of like one of the most important statements in Zen, so you should sit up and, you know, be interested. And so he says, good friends, my teaching of the Dharma, of Buddhist practice, takes meditation and wisdom as its basis. Never under any circumstances say mistake. Meditation and wisdom are different. They are a unity, not two things. Meditation itself is a substance of wisdom. Wisdom itself is the function of meditation. At the very moment when there is wisdom, then meditation exists in wisdom. At the very moment when there is meditation, then wisdom exists in meditation. Good friends, this means that meditation and wisdom are the same. Students, be careful not to say that meditation gives rise to wisdom, or that wisdom gives rise to meditation, or that meditation and wisdom are different from each other. To hold this view implies that things have duality. If good is spoken while the mind is, meditation and wisdom will not be alike. If mind and speech are both good, then the internal and external are the same, and meditation and wisdom are the same. An important piece here is, he keeps emphasizing, is he's encouraging us not to see meditation and wisdom as being two different things. And often there's a tendency in spiritual practice, and meditation practice, is to have a goal-oriented attitude towards the meditation. You're trying to get something, place, trying to get wisdom or get insight, get calm or joy or relaxation or whatever. And he's saying, please don't see it that way. See it as two of the same thing. But how, what does it take? Meditation practice. So you would see that meditation was not a means to wisdom or insight, but rather meditation itself was wisdom. And that wisdom, in a sense, is meditation. What does that take? Certainly then your meditation practice wouldn't be goal-oriented, because it has to happen right here. The moment of meditation has to be, in a sense, the moment of wisdom. And what does that take to do that? And maybe that you have to also kind of consider, what is wisdom then? And, you know, wisdom sometimes is this highfalutin, kind of full of all kinds of wonderful spiritual knowledge and insights and aphorisms and catchphrases. Or, you know, I don't know what wisdom is. But wisdom, I think, in the Buddhist tradition is not necessarily to be filled with all kinds of understanding. Good understanding, but more specifically has to do with a way in which we relate to the world around us, and maybe more specifically to relate to our experience in the world around us without any kind of clinging or aversion. That is a kind of wisdom in the Buddhist tradition, not to cling or identify strongly with our experience. So can you do that? Can you do that? Can that be the same thing as your meditation? Can a moment of awakening, of meditation, be the same thing as not clinging to this experience you're having right now, or not pushing it away? That's one way of understanding this. And, you know, Zen teachers can go on and on about trying to explain what this means. And maybe it's not to be, you know, completely understood. But the reason I brought this tonight was I studied this text some years ago when I was taking classes at Stanford. I took a class on Zen. And And so I went and looked at the Chinese. This was written originally in Chinese. I went to look at the Chinese. Actually, I had the back of the book there, the Chinese. And to see actually what some of these words actually were. And the word for wisdom, which is wei, it's pronounced wei. When I looked up that word in the dictionary didn't have wisdom as the definition of the word, but rather the definition of the word was kindness. So that kind of struck me. Why do they translate it as wisdom when the dictionary says it's supposed to be kindness? So then it reads very differently. Good friends, my teaching of the Dharma takes meditation and kindness as its basis. Never under any circumstances say it mistakenly that meditation and kindness are different. They are unity, not two things. Meditation itself is a substance of kindness. Kindness itself is a function of meditation. At the very moment when there is kindness, then meditation exists in kindness. At the very moment when there is meditation, then kindness exists in meditations. Good friends, this means that meditation and kindness are the same. Be careful not to say it gives rise to kindness, or that kindness gives rise to meditation, or that meditation and wisdom are different from each other. Meditation and kindness are different from each other. So that kind of reads a little differently. And then suddenly, you know, well, what is that? How is meditation and kindness the same? And how can you approach your practice that way? So I went back to my professors at Stanford, who, you know, are great scholars of Chinese language and Buddhism and all this. And this is, you know, what's going on here? And he said, oh, it's a scribal error. Because in Chinese, there's many characters. Chinese characters have the same pronunciation. And it turns out the character for wisdom and the character for kindness are pronounced the same. And in this case here, the characters also look somewhat like each other. So, you know, it could easily be that, you know, some scribe, you know, it used to be maybe oral tradition. He was writing down what he heard, and he kind of heard way, and he took the wrong way. But, and after all, what do these professors at Stanford know? So it's up to us, you know. And I myself am very fond, and probably both of them are good readings, but I'm very fond that it also can be read that meditation and kindness are the same thing. And so what does it take for your meditation to be the same thing as kindness? And there's many times when our meditation is really difficult, and there's painful feelings and agitation and anxiety and fear, and all these things happen. What does it mean to be kind in the midst of that? And partly, I think, to be kind to all that is certainly not to condemn either that or oneself, but rather to maybe embrace it or hold it in some wider sense or field of what? Of kindness, of acceptance. Not to condone it, not to kind of, you know, justify it or anything, but just what does it take to be kind? You can be kind even to your enemies, as the Dalai Lama loves to say. It's wonderful, the Dalai Lama, because here he is a leader, a great leader of Buddhism. He's kind of like the closest thing Buddhism has to a pope, though Buddhism doesn't have a pope, so you don't have to worry. But maybe, you know, the closest, you know, honorary pope or something. So he's so highly respected, not because of his position, I think because of his wisdom and his kindness. And he keeps saying over and over again that his religion is kindness. He doesn't say his religion is Buddhism. It's kindness. And he says, you know, what you should... He says he's not so interested in more Buddhists in the world. He wants to create more compassion and kindness in the world, and whatever that takes. So kindness. And then I quoted some weeks ago from Trungpa, who said that meditation is the continual act of befriending yourself. The continual act of being friends with yourself. So, the five spiritual faculties. The first is traditionally translated into English as faith. The second is energy or effort. The third is mindfulness. The fourth is concentration. Is wisdom or kindness or whatever. Which is usually wisdom. These things, they kind of balance each other. If mindfulness is in the middle, and on either side of those things are those aspects are paired, so that close to wisdom is close to mindfulness is effort and concentration, and those two are paired and need to come into balance. And then on the outer extremes is faith and wisdom, and faith and wisdom are a pair, and they also need to be balanced. And in a sense, the recognition of an emotional side of our life, and then maybe in the cognitive and intellectual side, it's one way of seeing this. And we get into trouble with any of these are imbalanced. So when there's too much faith and you have blind faith, there's a lot of problems that can end up with that. We're too easy to just accept what's told. We too blindly just kind of are in love with the Dharma and in love with our practice, but there's no real effort to engage yourself to understand or to be present or to discern what's actually happening. The kind of complacency can set up with too much faith. There's many problems. All of you can kind of think of examples of difficulties with too much faith. Wisdom, usually understood as being too much intellectual wisdom, too much understanding. You understand really well, and maybe your understanding is very close to being accurate, but it's all just ideas. And it's not the lived sense of participation in the world. It is an emotional connection with your own practice and yourself and the world around you. So it said these two need to be in the balance. And you can sometimes feel, you know, you have too much faith, or you have too much wisdom, you have too much understanding. People in the West tend to have too much understanding. They tend to read all these great Dharma books and come with all this intellectual understanding. What arises over time is the faith or the trust that comes from doing a practice oneself. And Buddhism is very clearly kind of against blind faith. Faith is kind of a word that has a spectrum of meanings. From maybe one extreme is maybe blind faith or belief, and the other, which I like, is trust or confidence. And so we slide back and forth along those. That's kind of spectrum. But I prefer words like trust and confidence, or maybe willingness. And in the context of meditation practice, it's a willingness to be present for what's happening, willingness to be with ourselves, a willingness to befriend ourselves. Or a trust, willing to trust that it's okay to be present, feeling that your experience is trustable, that it's okay to be present. You don't have to run away or justify or condemn or defend or explain or attack something or have doubt. You can say, okay, just to be who you are. And at least in this time of meditation, just accept yourself as this is what a human being is like at this particular hour of this particular year, this particular century, this particular millennia. One single human being in a world of 5 billion, this is what it's like. As opposed to, oh my God, I really blew it, and you know, I really am the world's greatest jerk, and you know, whatever stories we make, such strong feelings of unworthiness and inadequacy. And we're just part of this wonderful spark of life that exists. So it has some faith in ourselves, some faith, some trust in ourselves. So we're willing to enter into ourselves in the meditation, to relax into ourselves, to relax into the present moment. If then we're willing to do that, we have the willingness to do that, to trust ourselves in our experience, there's a tendency then to enter into our experience, to engage ourselves with the experience that we're having. And then engagement is the next spiritual faculty, which is energy or effort. As we engage, to engage yourself, what is this? I mean, since we enter it, Buddhism is somewhat against dualism. And to have this idea that you and your effort are two different things, or you and what you're trying to attain are two different things, is considered a little bit problematic in Buddhism. So the effort is something that arises out of you. So if there's a willingness and trust to listen to who you are and what your loudest voices are, what the loudest sensations in your body, the loudest emotions and feelings, and sense what those are, we talk about the predominant experience in meditation. So we find the predominant experience. If you find that, you'll find energy. If you find that and you trust entering and trust resting with it, without pushing it away, holding on to it, you'll find energy. So find that. What is that at this particular time? So it comes energy, engagement with the practice, really making an effort to pay attention, to be present. And it's really a miracle, this thing about awareness. I've been teaching it and practicing it for 20 years now, and the more I'm involved in it, the more I think it's really a miracle that this simple thing of bringing awareness to our life. It's kind of like, as I said earlier, it's a little bit strange way of speaking, but it's like we have two bodies or two breaths or two minds. The kind of body we have when we're not aware of it, we get tense, we're preoccupied. And there's a whole different body, in a sense, we have when we're aware of this body. And you might be aware of all the tension, but that's a very different body when you bring awareness to it. And awareness does things to that body. You can say it heals it. Just to bring awareness heals things, allows things to settle and relax. And if you cut yourself with it, you take a knife and cut your finger. In a sense, that's a willful act. It's pretty easy to cut your finger. You can decide to do it and do it. You can't decide and will the healing that I cut. You can do things to help, keeping it clean and doing things like that. But healing of that cut, something happens. The body knows what to do. And no matter how much your mind thinks, tries to will it and force it and insist on it and demand it, or it's in the body. All you have to do is get out of the way. Give it half a chance. Don't irritate it. Don't get in the way. Don't pull the scab. Those kinds of things. And I think the same thing with our inner life. Trustful awareness, willing awareness to our life. It's kind of like making the conditions just right. Things to unfold the way that they would I feel a little shy to say it this way, but it's what's occurring to me, as nature wishes. So first is having some trust, and it's very important in practice. And I think everybody who comes to practice comes with some kind of trust, some kind of confidence. It might be minuscule. It might be a little bit, that guy who's teaching, he seems to be somewhat trustable, maybe. So, I think I'll try it out. That's a good place. That's one place where a lot of people begin. Or you read a book and it's a little bit trustable. So you try it out and you test it. But pretty quickly, you have to find that it kind of has some meaning for you in your life. And so you find that it's trustable for you. That it makes bringing awareness make some sense as a practice. So it starts with confidence and trust. And then engagement, involvement with the practice, applying oneself to bring that marvelous, miraculous thing of awareness to our life. Today I had set myself up to do all this work on my dissertation. And I was frustrated a good part of the day from that intention, because first thing in the morning I found out my car was finally repaired at the mechanics. And so I had to go, I live way up on Skyline, so I had to go all the way down into Palo Alto to the mechanic. But first I had to go take the rental car back and then get, the rental car to the mechanic and pick up the car and drive all the way back. And then they're working on 84, so you have to kind of wait for, that's half an hour wait sometimes because of the work they're doing. So here I was, trying to be in my dissertation, and then someone called me, I had to see them. So lunchtime was kind of taken up, and then other things had to happen. And I kind of see, as I was driving down the hill to get my car, I could see, my day is not going to happen the way that I want it to happen. And I felt kind of slightly kind of worked up and a little bit tense. And it would have been very easy to have continued that way and kind of try to rush and hurry and try to squeeze in as much of time in my dissertation or whatever that I could, or I don't know what. What I decided to do instead was to say, today's going to be a day in the middle of a retreat for me. And on retreats, you don't get anything done. You don't get to work on your dissertation. You're just practicing mindfulness, being attentive and aware. So what a great day to do it. So today is going to be the day of the middle of a retreat for me. And it would just change the whole day. And I might have even gotten more done because of it. But I just kind of decided, instead of kind of being frazzled and trying to hurry home or whatever, here I am in the car. What is it like to be awake and present? I'm aware in the car. It was so easy. It wasn't exactly pleasant right away to be aware in the car because, I was a little bit tense. But it was this is the trick. It's not always pleasant to be mindful. That's why we're often so good at not being mindful. But it's deeply satisfying to be mindful. And that's what I hope that all of you will learn, is that pleasure and pleasantness is different from deep satisfaction. And I found that there's a deep satisfaction to be when you're present, even when things aren't pleasant. So faith and engagement or effort in the practice is important. The third is mindfulness. And these five things, right in the middle. Part of the reason for that is you can never have too much mindfulness. So it doesn't need to be balanced with anything. So just, you know, just do it as much as you can. And mindfulness is what we do here, just bringing careful attention, actually. Not simply bringing attention and trust to what's happening, but really kind of discerning it, seeing it, recognizing, this is what it is. This is what's happening. Waking up over and over again. So if you have trust, then you're willing to kind of... Then the tendency is you're willing to engage with what's happening. If you're willing to engage with what's happening, then you tend to become aware of what's happening. And if you're willing to enter into mindfully into what's happening with some engagement, some effort, then there's a tendency that you're often willing to sustain that attention for some time. Rather than just kind of flitting around whatever kind of occurs to your mind, you can kind of really, then your interest is stay in what is this? Kind of stay and get grounded. Ground oneself in this particular experience. What is this? I was in the car. You know, what was this tense shoulder like? Really, not just simply notice it and kind of go off and pay attention to something else, but get to know that really well. Sustain the attention for some time there. Or sustain the attention with this breath. What is this breath like? Sustained attention is concentration. And concentration is mindfulness, because as the concentration gets stronger, as the sustained awareness stays stronger, what's there reveals many different facets of itself to you, the component parts. You realize, for example, that, anger is not anger, just pure and simple. But anger is made up of all kinds. You sustain enough attention on anger, you see anger is made up of fear and hurt and frustration and, you know, other things also. And there's more interesting and more workable in a sense, more manageable when you start seeing more carefully what's actually there. But also with sustained attention comes a certain kind of level of calm or stability. And developing calm is not a be-all and end-all of meditation practice, but it's a very important part of allowing us to go deeper and deeper into the practice. If you can't really be kind to yourself unless you have some semblance of calm, I think. It doesn't have to be much. So then if you have this sustained attention, this concentration, then what's there tends to reveal itself. That you see it more clearly and you see different aspects of it. You see your relationship to it. You see its changing nature. You see how it relates to yourself. Whether, is it really you or is it not you? We tend to identify so strongly with different aspects of ourselves. Is a certain story you keep telling yourself over and over again, is it really who you are? Or is it just a story? So you say, there's a story. So wisdom arises from sustained attention. So from faith comes energy, from energy comes mindfulness, from mindfulness comes concentration, and from concentration comes wisdom. A symptom of too much wisdom and not enough faith is having a lot of doubt in practice. And the antidote to doubt is to have faith or find faith. And not necessarily abstract faith, but what can you trust? Not as a doctor, not as a belief, not as a person, not in anybody, but what can you trust in yourself? Can you find something you can trust? And not necessarily even what you believe. I met with someone the other day who talked a lot about his fear and anxiety. And in his situation, I felt like the opposite of his fear and all his doubts and was a trust. So I had him close his eyes and I asked him, where in his body could he find something that was trustable? Or where could he find some trust in his body? Physically, where you sense it. And in his situation, it could be different from different people. He felt it in his heart. So I encouraged him just to feel it there, sense it there, rest there. And he did for a while. And then I told him to connect it with his breathing and kind of help you feel the breath, kind of the movement of the breath going through that area as a way of staying present for that sensation of trust. And as he did that, he kind of visibly relaxed. And he had no idea that he had resources within him of having there's some place that was trustable that he could go to and was kind of refuge of trust. He was living so much in his head with all his fear and self-criticism and doubts. And he became very calm and very peaceful and very happy from this very simple exercise. So trust does not necessarily mean some, you know, belief system, but it can actually mean something physically. What do you trust here right now in yourself? And you can start there when you practice. I did this to someone else recently, and for her, it was her hands. That was kind of like the entryway then for her into finding another way of being present for herself. And, you know, as you know, mindfulness practice is not the practice of finding some other way of being with ourselves. It's really waking up to what's here. But if there's a lot of doubt and a lot of self-criticism, a lot of things, feeling unworthiness or inadequacy or agitation or whatever, sometimes it's nice to kind of just see if you notice something which has been overlooked. And sometimes things that are very important get overlooked because we have a certain lens on that says, I'm only going to look through the lens of inadequacy. That's all that counts, right? And sometimes you just put that lens off and what else is there to create some balance. So sometimes we need to have more faith in practice. Sometimes we need to have more energy. If there's too much concentration is synonymous with calm. And so with too much concentration and calm, we tend to get kind of sleepy and dull in our meditation. So you don't want to get too concentrated without the proper balance of effort and energy. So you want to keep your energy up and not be seduced into the pleasantness of just calm and kind of drift away in it and get calmer and calmer until finally you're sleeping and getting dull. And that's why it's very important, I think, to have some mindfulness of your posture as you meditate. You don't have to have a lot. Your posture relatively straight when you meditate. Because what happens is when you get really calm, your posture tends to slump and fall forward. And if you have some semblance of mindfulness, some mindfulness of your posture, you'll then notice when you start slumping. And that's a sign that maybe you need to reinvigorate your meditation practice. And one way to do that is to sit up a little bit straighter, back in a kind of alert posture again. If there's too much energy, then we can be really agitated. You can be restless. And so what we need as a balance with too much energy, calm, is some concentration. And the way to do that is to be very, very simple in your meditation for a little while and just rest on a single object. You can rest on your agitation itself, or you can rest just with your breath. Just stay with your breath for some time. And breath is one of the preeminent ways of calming down a little bit. It doesn't always work. But sometimes it can be very helpful to create some calm. Or sometimes if you find yourself really agitated before you're going to do your sitting meditation, if you do walking meditation for 10, 15, 20 minutes before you sit, that can kind of calm things down. And so you can come and sit in a little bit more balanced way. As a mindfulness practice develops and matures, these five spiritual faculties are kind of like five spiritual potentials that we have. And often they're kind of latent or dormant or whatever. It's said that as the meditation practice develops, these five spiritual potentials or faculties get a new name. And they become known as the five spiritual powers. And they become powers that we have that are a great ally, in a sense, for a spiritual practice. Something that we can use and really. And since to tie it to this to this wonderful quote about meditation and kindness being the same thing, I would perhaps we can say that these five faculties are five different aspects that support kindness. And in order to be kind to oneself, to befriend oneself, and be kind to the world, there has to be some semblance of these five things. There has to be some engagement with a situation. There has to be some mindfulness. There has to be some sustained attention to what's going on. And there has to be some understanding of what's there. Some wisdom. So, any questions or comments? Yeah.
A little bit about the nature of walking meditation.
How many of you are interested in learning more about walking meditation? That's enough of you, and maybe we should do it next week. Because sometimes I do it, you know, like last year after this introductory course, I did it. But in some ways I have a poor memory. And sometimes I have this really great memory. And for me, it was like it was only 3 weeks ago I gave this talk on the walking meditation. And I can't imagine any of you want to hear it again. It's kind of difficult to remember that, you know, it's a whole group, new group of people after a year. So, I'm okay? I gave a talk on walking meditation. Can you come next week? Oh. Uh-oh. Maybe we should wait. Well, I'm not going to be here the following week. So we just wait a few weeks? So next time I'm back, I'll do it. And since you were the one who asked, we'll wait until you're here. Yes?
Thinking about the difference between wisdom and kindness. And I know that I feel intuitively much more comfortable with the word kindness. With the word wisdom. Wisdom is unattainable. And I wouldn't want to be known as a wise person. It's very uncomfortable. People tell me why. But I want to be known as kind. I don't think it was described as error.
Sorry?
I don't think it was described with error.
We'll have to rewrite the Zen history. Imagine what the Zen tradition would be like if they had read that as kindness rather than wisdom down through the centuries. Slowly, you know, through the centuries, it would have shaped it slightly different. Maybe. Other comments? Did it seem to have any relevance to your own meditation practice, this discussion of the five faculties? Could you see maybe how it related, or? Yeah? Any other questions, or anything you want to ask about your own practice?
I'm curious about the way these things pertain or don't pertain to, like, Western religion, or you see them as integral in Buddhism and meditation as a whole.
Well, the way I hear that question, it's a very vague question. Kind of, you know, I don't know where to begin, even where the entrance is.
Do you feel there's any conflict with these things?
I think in principle not. And Buddhism has been an amazingly adaptive religion. It's almost as if the interest of Buddhism, the area of interest, is different from the interest often of other religions. So they're not necessarily in conflict. And Buddhism doesn't have this idea that you have to only believe in one religion at a time. Like it's this or this and nothing else. So it's quite easy to be a Buddhist and a Christian at the same time. It's not a problem for Buddhism, but it might be a problem for some Christians. But from the Buddhist side, it's okay, so at least you don't have to worry that side. But and there have been a lot of Christians who have they say they benefited tremendously from contact with Buddhist practice. Some of the leading Zen teachers in Europe, actually Zen given they practiced in Japan, and they were given authorization to be Zen teachers, Zen masters, are Catholic monks and nuns. And there's a Catholic monk in Texas who is a Zen teacher, and I think there's a guy up in there's some guy up here, some priest or Catholic monk or priest somewhere here in the peninsula. I think he taught at some convent or something. An older man who practiced in Japan for a long time, and he teaches Zen meditation to the nuns up wherever in the peninsula he is, does his thing. Maybe that's where it is. And I've listened. You know, I've had contact with some Catholic monks who do Catholic prayer and stuff. And it's amazing how much similarity and commonality we have. And you know, if we're going to talk about the Trinity, and and the Dharma and the three bodies of the Buddha and all these kind of esoteric doctrines, we might miss each other entirely. But as soon as we drop, the abstract doctrines and talk about the practice, monastic schedules we followed when we were monks and the experiences we have and what happens as we practice, it's like talking to someone who's done the same practice for years. So much commonality and friendship and warmth and intimacy. Brother David Stindl Rost, who's a Catholic monk, said once that he has more in common with Buddhist monks than he has with most lay Christians, because they share so much in lifestyle and practices. And I've met monks, and one fantastic Catholic teacher of contemplative prayer is Father Keating. He wrote a beautiful book called Open Heart, Open Mind, do we call it? Beautiful book. And I felt a real resonance with my own practice with the way he taught. But it depends what you're looking at and what you're looking for. And the religions, as traditions, are so hugely diverse within themselves that it's pretty easy to find incompatibilities. And it's not so difficult to find compatibilities. It depends on what you want to focus on.
Follow on. How about the relationship between Zen and Taoism? They seem quite similar in some ways.
Yeah, it's been said by many scholars that what Zen is a blending of Buddhism and Taoism. That when Buddhism came to China, it was heavily influenced by Taoist thought and Taoist terminology. Zen, and then Zen even more was influenced kind of by Taoism. And I think I believe there's a lot of truth to that. Maybe not, might not be 50-50, equal amounts of each, but. But then once Zen came to Japan, to some degree it was also, then in Japan it was influenced by certain indigenous Japanese beliefs, Shinto kind of sensibilities. And so Chinese Zen feels quite different from Japanese Zen because of the influences. And then if you come to America, in Japanese tradition in America, we have Chinese influence in Buddhism, we have influence on Buddhism, and now we're having American influence on Buddhism. And so I just, each place Buddhism goes, will perfume it.
Is Zen a branch or something?
Zen is a branch of Buddhism. There's many branches, and that's one branch. And it's said sometimes that the branch of Buddhism that we're connected to here, because that's what I'm teaching in, is called the Theravada tradition, and teaching Vipassana within it. In schools of Buddhism, it's sometimes said that the school that's most closely aligned to the Vipassana movement, Vipassana Buddhism, is Zen. They have Zen is also diverse. It depends what kind of Zen. But in particular, Soto Zen and the Zen of Dogen. Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, his teaching of Zen has often been likened very much with Vipassana practice.
For the sake of the world, which is about Christianity and Buddhism.
Ah.
Donald Swear wrote the Buddhist part, and I think Patrick Henry wrote the Christian part.
for the sake of the world.
So I had a question about intention. I don't know if you talked about this last week, but from the meditation instructions, it talks a lot about that. To notice when you do something, but when you're sitting there meditating, there's not too many. There's not too many movements you're going to make unless you're in an uncomfortable position.
Yeah.
Assuming that's something broader, you're supposed to apply to other areas of your life.
Anywhere they arise. It isn't so much that you kind of make this a task. Now I'm going to look for intentions and wait for the next one or whatever. But it's more like you hear that instruction, and it's somehow it registers enough. Maybe you have to hear it a few times. That somehow it's kind of there, so that when an intention arises, you're kind of cued to notice it more. And when you're sitting and up moving in meditation, there's not any intentions to act in any kind of way. You might want to itch or change your posture. And so you might notice the intention before you do that. And what is that intention? What's in that intention? Are you doing it because out of wisdom that if you don't change your posture a little bit now, your foot's going to fall asleep. It's going to take you 2 hours to stand up. And by that time, well, I've locked you in. But you better change your posture. That sounds like a wise decision. Or is it, I hate this pain. This is really the god awful worst thing I could ever have, and I'm just going to get rid of it. And so you change out of that. So those are two very different intentions. So to see what your intention gives you information of your kind of motivation, the rationale behind it, and it makes a world of difference in the grammar of the equations of the heart and how these things work. So when you meditate, there might not be gross movements, but there might be subtle intentions. And as the meditation gets more subtle, you might notice the subtler intentions, which are all in the mind in a sense. And so for example, you might get sleepy in your meditation. And the intention to, you might hate it, and you try to get rid of it or try to avoid it. So the intention is to sit up straight as an avoidance, rather than from some reason of wisdom. And that's a world of difference. And so can you notice that? Or say you have a real pleasant train of thought or a real pleasant state of mind. There can be an intention can arise to hold on to that. So you can watch intention in place, both subtle and grossly. And it can be really fun to follow intention, to pay attention to it, and especially in daily life, especially with grosser things, what is the intention here? When I did a long retreat once, a 3-month retreat, in the middle of the retreat, the teacher said, "Okay, now start noticing the intention." And it became just an amazing world. And I went to my interview a day or two later, and I said, "I don't understand why I do anything." Because there was no self behind the intention. Where the intention just arises. There's no, I'm not there. This is an intention. So why do I do it? Where does an intention coming from? And I felt like I was living in this kaleidoscope world of kind of a grace.
So you just do the same thing you do with anything else.
Yeah. If you notice an intention is there, you could just say intention. Yeah.
Not then do that act that you were going to do? Or?
Well, that's where common sense is very important. And then if you see the intention, you see what's behind it a little bit, then you can decide. And, is it useful to do it? Is it not useful? Is it harmful to do it? Is it not harmful? Is the motivation behind it selfish or aversive, or is it kind and generous? But one of the traps that people have sometimes when we start noticing intentions is sometimes intentions are a mixed bag of things, and there can be mixed intentions. There can be that you genuinely want to help your friend move or whatever, and you want to help your friend move because you know, you want to look like, you know, to all your friends and neighbors, you want to look like you're the super neighbor who is always helpful. You know, you get this identity, you kind of put a badge on and say, I'm the great helper or whatever. And that's not necessarily, you know, it could be from, so you're doing it more for selfish reasons rather than selfless reasons. So, might be operating. And what some people do is they paralyze themselves because they notice that there's a little bit of what's going on is a selfish reason. And that's kind of sad sometimes when part of the motivation was beautiful motivation and it actually did some good for the world. It's kind of sad then to paralyze yourself because you noticed, you know, something that you some intention you weren't happy with. So you can kind of weigh it out and, you know, and sometimes you do it anyway, knowing that part of the intention is not necessarily so good. Oh. So let's sit.